It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it. Do you realize that it has been 5 years since Cesaro ran into the crowd at SummerSlam and tore a beach ball apart with his bare hands? Let us never forget that that beach ball had a family. I shall pour out some SPF 50 later in tribute. This is episode 770 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, August 21st, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. If you were looking for great wrestling this week, you did not have to look far. We got some good ones on Raw Monday night. NXT Heatwave was a pretty good show on Tuesday. Bryan Danielson and Daniel Garcia went 3 falls on Dynamite. The G1 final with Okada and Will Ospreay was tremendous, as was the Fatal 4-Way on SmackDown, or Fatal 5-Way. I should say Fatal 5-Way on SmackDown. But this was not a week without drama, and we got plenty of that from the AEW side with one CM Punk. It has been 1 year since Punk came back, and I'm going to have thoughts on that. All the controversy coming out of that promo on Wednesday night, the death of NXT UK, Triple H undoing something else that Vince McMahon did that made talent very unhappy at the time. And I'm going to talk about the DX episode of the A&E biography as well. And some thoughts at the very end on the Better Call Saul finale, for those who are interested in that sort of thing. But first, I got to tell you that former WWE head writer Brian Gewirtz is out with a new book that just dropped this week. He even had The Rock on Instagram Live with Becky Lynch and Seth Rollins to help him promote it. It's called There's Just One Problem, which is something Goldberg said to him on Goldberg's very first night in the company. Getting things off on the right foot, I see, with Big Bill. But you can download the audiobook version for free right now when you use our Audible link to sign up for a 30-day trial. So go ahead, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. You know, most writers in WWE, they last weeks or months. I don't want to say they all last weeks, but weeks or months. It's a lot of turnover when it comes to creative writers in WWE. Somehow, Gewirtz managed to last 15 years in that company. That's a long time. From the Attitude Era, through the Ruthless Aggression Era, the PG Era, the so-called Reality Era. But the book is said to be a great read, a lot of fun stories, a lot of wrestlers have been promoting it on their social media channels. You can get it for free. And if you are an Amazon Prime member, you can use our link and get 2 free books. So you can grab the Brian Gewirtz book, and you can grab the Jon Moxley book, which he narrates himself. So it won't cost you a thing. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster, so take advantage of that. I want to say thank you to all of our PayPal producers this week. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on this show, which is heard all around the world. DeVenom Johnny Rue. John, thank you very much. John has been a big-time contributor, especially over the last few weeks, so I want to just express my appreciation to him. Thank you, John. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. John Loose Cannon Lopez. James Hollywood Herrera. Forgot he had turned heel. I just got the alert on my phone. Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, just dropped a big PayPal donation. Michelle, thank you very much. I'm glad I glanced over. I said, wait a minute, what is this? What's popping up here on my screen? And literally in mid-sentence as I am starting this, I see that she dropped a PayPal donation. So Michelle, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Big B, Brian Becerra, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Killshot, Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Caleb Showtime, Lindley, The Firebomber, Craig Foster, Superkick, that's right, old Superkick here, Shinakuma, who wants to give a shout out to our PayPal and our YouTube family. Shout out to Ricardo, his girlfriend, Judy, tells me that he is a huge fan of the Sound Off. He's been listening since the very first episode. And she tells me that today is your 40th birthday. So, R-Link, this shout-out is for you. Wishing you a happy birthday and thanking you for sticking with me for 15 years. That's awesome. So happy birthday, brother. And please, if you can, support our friend Steve. His niece, Emma, is 18 years old. She was just weeks away from starting college at Seton Hall, but she has been in the hospital for almost the entire month now. After suffering multiple strokes, brain bleeds, other life-threatening, awful issues. It's going to be a long road to recovery. I know they're trying to raise money to assist with all of her medical bills. You can help by visiting their GoFundMe page if you search for the title. Help pay for Emma Villarola's medical bills. That's V-I-L-L-I-A-R-O-L-A. Search for that title. That is the place to go. Anything you can do to help will go a long way. It's a terrible situation, so... As I said to him privately, I'm thinking about him and his family, and again, hopefully she can turn things around, I hope very soon. I know Zach is also going through a tough time as well. He's been a longtime listener since the TV Tracks days. His aunt Carol's recovering from open heart surgery. He's just looking for some positive vibes from the Sound Off family. I'm sure you will all send them his way. So Zach, I'm thinking about you as well. We're 1 week away. 1 week, 7 days from the biggest show in House of Glory history. High intensity from Terminal 5 in New York City. I'm getting goosebumps. I'm getting excited for this. The House of Black invades House of Glory. Malakai Black, Brody King, Buddy Matthews. We've got Brody King challenging Jacob Fatu to crown a new House of Glory world champion. Can't go wrong with either one of those guys. Malakai Black and The Amazing Red, they're finally going to meet in a match that was originally scheduled to happen last December at our For the Glory event before Red got injured. 8 months later, it's finally happening. Eddie Kingston steps into the ring for the first time with the Japanese legend Naomichi Marufuji. I can remember sitting in the Manhattan Center watching Marufuji at a Ring of Honor show many, many years ago. We're probably going back 15 years. 13, 14, 15 years. So to be able to call one of his matches for the first time is going to be a really fun experience for me. Joey Janela is coming in. He's challenging Charles Mason for the House of Glory Crown Jewel Championship. The Briscoes are going to defend their House of Glory tag team titles in an open challenge. Just announced, Bandido will be making his House of Glory debut. He was fantastic on the Ric Flair's Last Match pay-per-view. He takes on Low Key. Bandido replaces Killer Cross, who is now the number two heel on SmackDown. I was hoping WWE would allow him to finish out all of his dates, but evidently that is not the case. But no complaints about a Bandido and Low Key match. And we will have the inaugural Matt Travis Memorial Battle Royal honoring the late House of Glory legend with the winner getting an HOG championship match of his choosing. All that and a lot more. That's not even the entire card. That's not even nearly the entire card. So tickets are available at hogwrestling.net. You can stream it live on Fight. If you have never checked out a House of Glory show before, this is the one that you need to buy. If I had to recommend one show to you, this is going to be that one show. So make sure you don't miss that. The fear I talked about last week for the future of the NXT UK brand turned out to be well-founded with the announcement this week that NXT UK, as we currently know it, will cease to exist as WWE prepares to launch what they are referring to as NXT Europe in 2023. So Triple H's plans from years ago for a global NXT expansion look to be back on. How long before we start hearing about NXT Japan or NXT Mexico? He's been planning this for almost a decade. Now he has the power to actually make it happen. He's not wasting any time. In the announcement, they referred to Shawn Michaels as the Vice President of Talent Development Creative, and some people took that to be a new title, like he just got a promotion. That has been his title for the past 2 years, so that is nothing new. But this is what he said in the press release. Following the success of our live events and talent identification efforts throughout all of Europe, we believe this is the perfect time to expand NXT beyond the UK. NXT Europe will reimagine the brand and its talent pipeline with a pan-European focus. So officially, publicly, the NXT UK brand is going on hiatus for a few months, but they've already gone and dismantled the entire roster. Tons of talent releases this week. Vince McMahon may be gone, but his spirit lives on. Got another wave of mass releases here, including Trent Seven, who has been there from the beginning. Flash Morgan Webster, Mark Andrews, Sam Gradwell, Dave Mastiff, Wild Boar, which is a great name for a wrestler, Jack Stars, Millie McKenzie, Zaya Brookside, Eddie Dennis, Saxton Huxley, Amir Jordan, Sid Scala, T-Bone, Shaw Samuels, Oliver Carter, Jason Melrose, Nina Samuels, Ashton Smith, Danny Luma, Teoman, Kenny Williams, and Amale, as well as their TV announcer, Kirsty Bosley. Many of them have since confirmed their departures on social media. No mention of Ilya Dragunov, who recently had to forfeit the NXT UK title due to injury, or the current NXT UK Women's Champion, Mako Satomura. I cannot imagine either of them are going to be going anywhere. I'm sure they're safe. Per PW Insider, they are shutting down the brand to strategize the best way to launch NXT Europe next year, and the idea of touring regionally when the time is right. That's something they never did with NXT UK. It was just the television show and that was it. The door is said to be open for some of the released talents to be brought back down the road, and that with such a long hiatus until the relaunch, it didn't make any sense to keep everybody under contract. That sounds to me like, if that's true, this NXT Europe thing isn't coming until deep into next year. Because if it was coming in the next few months, they wouldn't have cut all these people. Now, on the NXT Heatwave special last Tuesday, we saw more of the UK faces pop up, including the entire Gallus faction, Joe Coffey, Mark Coffey, and Wolfgang, who laid out all the members of Diamond Mine. Blair Davenport, the former B Priestley, confronted Indy Hartwell in a backstage segment. And at the end of the show, after Bron Breakker retained his NXT championship over JD McDonagh, who's another NXT UK import, Tyler Bate walked out with his NXT championship, and the two of them had a stare down. Now, if you are an NXT UK fan who tries to avoid spoilers since they tape so far ahead in advance, you probably were not very thrilled to see him walk out there with that championship, because Tyler Bate has not yet won the title on TV. On TV, the title is still vacant. Even on WWE.com, at least when I checked the other day, if you go to the superstar section, the champion is still listed as vacant. Yet there he was, with the belt on Tuesday. But this is all to set up the next Worlds Collide event with NXT stars wrestling the stars from NXT UK. They have not done one of these Worlds Collide specials in a few years, but they're doing one the same day as AEW's All Out pay-per-view. But the NXT show will air at 4 o'clock Eastern on Peacock. Should end around the time that the buy-in pre-show begins. So they're not overlapping, but they are running on the same day. After that, the NXT UK brand will officially cease to exist. So we know of at least two matches so far for that special. Bron Breakker against Tyler Bate and Diamond Mine against Gallus. It is no coincidence that WWE is running not one but two shows the same weekend as AEW's biggest show of the year. AEW has had a lock on Labor Day weekend for the past few years, probably 3 years now. I don't believe WWE has ever run a big event that weekend, and all of a sudden they have two. What a coincidence. What an unbelievable coincidence. It seemed pretty clear NXT UK was on its last legs when they started bringing different talents over to the main brand, and then they canceled all the future television tapings. I mean, that was a telltale sign right there. WWE just never put any kind of promotional muscle behind the brand. I can't imagine the numbers for it were any good. You know, I didn't watch the show every week, but when I heard about a great match, I tuned in. You know, NXT UK, if we think about the legacy of this brand, right? NXT UK did give us some fantastic matches, including those two matches with Walter and Ilya Dragunov. I think those are two of the best matches in company history, main roster or otherwise, across any brand. You can add Walter against Tyler Bate to that list from TakeOver Cardiff. COVID deprived us of Walter against Finn Balor in Dublin 2 years ago. That still pisses me off. Pete Dunne against Tyler Bate in Chicago for the UK title. I mean, it gave us a lot of quality wrestling. But outside of a few big shows, it was the forgotten brand. You know, by and large, the last 5 years, it was the forgotten brand. Now they're going to try out their plan for world domination, starting with Europe. In countries like France and Germany and Italy. You know, I don't know how healthy the independent scenes are right now in those places, and I would love to hear from my international listeners. We have a lot of them. Generally speaking, when WWE comes in, that is not good news for the independent scene in those places. That is not looked upon as a positive. They want to come in and put their stamp on things. They want to come in and take control. They want to get people under contract. When people are under contract, they control them. They control their careers. They control where they can wrestle. And when, it's smart for WWE to recruit talent from all different countries, but when they come in, they take over, which is why the NXT TakeOver name was so appropriate. It was always the plan. They come in, they sign up all the good talent, they sign contracts that limit what other places they can work. They came into the UK, and I don't get the sense that the scene over there is as strong as it was before. Now, the whole speaking out movement had a lot to do with that because there were a lot of UK promotions and talent that were caught up and swept up in that. And it was just this whole really, you know, crazy situation. That didn't help either. But I don't get the sense that the scene over there is nearly as strong as it was before WWE came in and started doing the whole NXT UK thing. That's the fear. When WWE comes knocking, they want to, you know, if you're a local promoter, you've got to have a lump in your throat right now hearing this news. But this was always the plan. It all goes back to what I said on episode 374 of The Sound Off. That was 7 years ago, by the way, when I recorded that episode. And I said it then. Why is Triple H signing all of this indie talent? Why did he suddenly become such a big fan of the indies? To try to kill Ring of Honor, for one. Ring of Honor was practically the feeder system for WWE anyway for a long time. Triple H wanted to create his own super indie and create talent from within. And take credit for creating talent from within the company. He raided the indie scene of as much talent as he could to try to weaken it. And partner with a few smaller promotions that pose no threat. These promotions that they partnered with, you know, pose no imminent threat to him. Or WWE. So he can gain access to even more talent. He would host these conference calls with the wrestling media, talk about teaching all of these people the WWE playbook when they bring them in. Everything they learned elsewhere doesn't matter. You know, when you come to WWE, it's like coming to a new team. You got to learn our plays. You got to learn our style. Forget everything you learned before. You know, they're going to basically deprogram you. That's what they do. I think Triple H gained an appreciation for the indie guys over time that he didn't maybe have when he was in his prime in the ring. He built an entire brand around them and found success for a while. Changed the whole viewpoint that some people even had of Triple H changed because of what he did with NXT. But it was all part of a longer-term strategy that, as we now see, is still playing out to this day. Now, the rest of that Heatwave show from Tuesday, I liked using Paul Heyman for the intro video, given that Heatwave was an old ECW show, so having Heyman do the read was very clever. Carmelo Hayes and Giovanni Vinci was good stuff. I know that they could do even better if we get to see it again. Both of those guys are very, very good. Cora Jade and Roxanne Perez, they had a good first outing. I say first because this felt like the start of something much longer between them. Santos Escobar loses to Tony D'Angelo. He is officially main roster bound. It's about time. I would have kept Legado del Fantasma together. Maybe they can reunite them on the main roster in the future. But, you know, just like they did with Imperium, it feels like they're breaking up a group for no good reason. Escobar should have been on Raw or SmackDown a lot sooner, but better late than never. He will be a fine addition to the main roster. Mandy Rose had a surprisingly good match with Zoe Stark, maybe the best I've seen out of Mandy. She retains her NXT Women's Championship. Zoe apparently suffered a concussion during the match, which is why she was taken out of the Women's Tag Team Title Tournament on Friday. They held Nikita Lyons out of it as well, because per the Observer, she is not vaccinated for COVID, and therefore she would have been unable to cross the border for SmackDown in Montreal. So they replaced them both with Gigi and JC from Toxic Attraction, who, honestly, they should have just put Toxic Attraction in this tournament from the very start. I just assume, naturally, they're having a tag team title tournament on television if they're going to bring anybody up from NXT. You've got these two women who have, you know, a good act going, former two-time NXT Women's Tag Team Champions. They just recently lost those titles. Why wouldn't they be in the tournament? Unless they're just not planning on calling them up anytime soon. So they should have been in this thing from day one. They ended up beating Natty and Sonya to advance to the next round. They're going to take on Raquel and Aaliyah this Friday. And Bron Breakker retained his NXT title over JD McDonagh. Good match. I couldn't even for a second picture McDonagh going over on Bron and taking the championship. So this just felt like a defense to kind of get to whatever the next big defense is going to be for Breakker, which could be Apollo Crews. Or maybe Tony D'Angelo. I guess we'll see now that Tony is done with Santos Escobar and he got a big win this week. Maybe he's next in line. Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful Select broke the news this week that an AEW talent who was under contract with the company recently went to management to reveal that WWE reached out to them about a possible return to the company. And the claim is that it was a member of WWE's talent relations department that reached out to this person. And the source close to AEW told Fightful that they had referred the call to their representation instead of speaking directly. I assume that means legal representation. The site was able to confirm the story with the talent in question, who wishes to remain anonymous for now. They made it clear they're very happy working for AEW. They have no desire to leave right now. Sources familiar with the situation told Fightful that there was no mistake that this performer was already under a full-time contract with AEW. And Fightful reached out to WWE's reps, who have thus far not commented on the matter. I'm going to bet that they will not be commenting on the matter anytime soon. You know, the key word there is return. They tried to get somebody to return to the company, which would eliminate any AEW originals, I guess, from that list. The first name, honestly, when I heard this story and I saw the word return, the first name that popped into my head was Swerve Strickland, who is currently one half of the AEW Tag Team Champions. This story came out just days after Hit Row returned on SmackDown. Triple H has been bringing back NXT talents. I could easily see him wanting to get Swerve back to reunite all the members of Hit Row. You know, contract tampering is nothing new in wrestling. Both companies have done it, or they've walked right up to that line. You know, they've skirted the line. Earlier this year, Jeff Hardy, he let it slip that he was going to AEW. The problem is, he said that while he was still under contract to WWE. Oops. His non-compete had not yet expired. It was pretty clear that he was going to end up going to AEW. There was going to be a Hardy Boys reunion. Tony Khan was going to, you know, put that together. But they legally would not be allowed to negotiate or sign anything until he was free and clear, and so he shot his mouth off a little early, and then he had to backtrack and say, I was only kidding, you know, or I was taken out of context, whatever it was that he said. Chris Jericho has told the story of his secret meeting, his clandestine meeting with Vince McMahon at Vince's house while he was still under contract with WCW. They all do it. This is hardly some new practice. It's up to the companies to make sure that they do it covertly so they don't get caught. That's really what it boils down to. It's only cheating if you get caught. Right? Then they get very upset and then they can sue. But it's okay when they do it, right? That's what I love about it. That's what I love, you know? The WWE, maybe they would have been very upset about the Jeff Hardy thing and, yeah, but it's okay when they do it. So anyway, what's good for one should be good for the other. I love this mentality of rules for thee and not for me. But again, this is hardly some new practice in wrestling. This kind of stuff goes on, I'm sure, far more than any of us know. It was 1 year ago yesterday that CM Punk made his return to professional wrestling at the United Center in Chicago. After 7 years away, he made his AEW debut, and it has largely been a positive for the company. Don't let anybody tell you that up to this point, oh, it's been such a failure. Oh, it's been such a negative. It has largely been a positive for AEW. People were excited to see this man back. Wrestlers and the company were excited to work with him. I know he's given advice to a lot of the younger talents that have come up to him behind the scenes. He's had great matches with Darby Allin, Eddie Kingston, MJF, Hangman Page, Dax Harwood. Punk has said he thinks the match he had with Dax is the most perfect match that he's ever had. That's how highly he thinks of that match. I'm sure he and Tanahashi would have had a memorable one at Forbidden Door had he not broken his foot. And think of all the names that he still hasn't even touched since he came back. Kenny Omega, Bryan Danielson, who I know he's dying to work with, Adam Cole. You know, there's lots of other big matches waiting for him. Tony Khan would tell you that Punk has increased business for them. Maybe not television ratings outside of that first week, but in a lot of other ways, like pay-per-view business, the company is bigger today than it was a year ago when Punk first arrived, and he definitely played a role in that. You cannot deny that. Tony has called him the biggest part of financial success in the history of AEW. He said no one person has ever made more of a positive impact. He might be singing a different tune after this week. There was major news coming out of Dynamite with the announcement that the championship unification match between Punk and Jon Moxley, which was slated for All Out, will instead be taking place on Dynamite this Wednesday. Punk against Moxley, that's the biggest possible match that AEW can do right now. Champion against champion, unification, and they're giving it away on free television on 1 week's notice. And if it feels like it's being done on short notice, that's because it is. At least according to Fightful, it was a late decision made by Tony Khan. This is not something that was planned and mapped out for weeks and everything is just playing out exactly the way it was originally expected to play out. This was a late call by Tony Khan. Now, the question, of course, is why would he make a late call to bump the matchup? That we don't know. But, you know, Eric Bischoff once did the same thing with Goldberg and Hollywood Hogan on Nitro, but they were in front of 40,000 people at the Georgia Dome. And Bischoff was desperate for a win because WCW was starting to get thumped by WWE. I think it's insane to hotshot their first meeting 11 days before the pay-per-view. I mean, they could always run it back at All Out. In fact, I kind of expect them to do that. But you're still giving away that first one-on-one encounter. And you're doing it with all the commercial breaks that come with delivering a long match like this on live television. But since then, we have learned some things that are going on behind the scenes that may have played a part in the decision to bump up the match. And if any of this is true, it is not good. It's not good if you are Tony Khan having to deal with all of this. If you're a fan, I think it makes for great drama. As somebody said in the live chat on the stream the other night, TNT, we love drama, right? I love drama too. I love me some good drama. It's a podcaster's delight. Are you kidding me? But there's a lot of drama right now centered around the AEW World Champion, and that is not good for AEW. I cannot imagine that Tony Khan would give this match away early unless he has a damn good reason for doing so. You know, I thought maybe Hangman Page might factor into things after the way Punk bitched him out on TV on Wednesday. Maybe he would, I don't know if he would interfere, but maybe coming out of it, he would be involved in some way. They'd make it a triple threat at the pay-per-view. None of that appears to be the case. At all. Well, I'll have more on that in a moment. That leaves one other scenario. And that is the return of MJF. MJF has been missing since the post-Double or Nothing episode of Dynamite where he called Tony Khan a fucking mark. It was CM Punk during the commercial break who hobbled to the ring on a foot that he didn't know yet was shattered to chase MJF off into the crowd, and he has not been seen since. That is not the only history between Punk and MJF. MJF has a win over Punk in Chicago earlier this year and a loss to Punk in their dog collar match at Revolution. They're 1-1. And I've been saying ever since then that it's CM Punk who MJF should defeat to win his first AEW World Championship. They have been waiting for Punk to come back. Now he's back. And now it is safe for MJF to poke his head back out again. But that could all be in jeopardy if the wrestling news websites are to be believed, and I am including reputable ones like PW Insider and Fightful in there. This isn't just coming from pistachionutwrestlingwrapup.net. We have to take it all the way back to the start of the show on Wednesday, which saw CM Punk come to the ring for a promo. But before he said anything about Jon Moxley, his next opponent, he decided to take some shots at the former champion, Hangman Adam Page, who he won the title from at Double or Nothing back in May. He said there was someone in the area, or someone from the area, because I guess Hangman grew up not far from where they were on Wednesday. There was someone from the area that he wanted to challenge to a rematch, and he dared Hangman to come to the ring right now and fight him for the championship. And it seemed very odd, even the announcers were kind of taken off guard by this, because Hangman has barely even been mentioned since he lost the title. I mean, Hangman was, he was there, but he did not come out. And then Punk gave him some advice. He said, the public apology needs to be as loud as the disrespect. He said, that's not cowboy shit, that's coward shit. He completely buried the guy. Especially when he didn't come out because he wasn't scheduled to come out. And Punk knew that he wasn't scheduled to come out because allegedly Punk went into business for himself. And what he said about Hangman was not planned. It wasn't that it wasn't scripted, because they don't use scripts in AEW, but it wasn't planned. And there are said to be real issues between the two dating back to the promos that Hangman cut on Punk leading into their match. Now, when I did the Dynamite post-show, I said it makes sense if you remember what I said about those promos at the time. When Hangman was talking about Punk, I joked about how angry Hangman was, seemingly for no apparent reason. Even Punk said to him, I don't know why you're so angry. I don't know why you're taking this so personally. And he was right. It didn't really make sense. Hangman was basically calling Punk a wolf in sheep's clothing. Someone not to be trusted. Someone who is not in it to help. He's in it to help himself. He's not in it to help anybody else. He's a fraud. That's basically what he was saying. And Page said it was his job to save AEW from CM Punk. Punk had never done anything on camera to play into this idea that he had some sort of hidden agenda. This, it just felt like it came from a place where it was kind of being forced, and it just very weird. But others like MJF and Eddie Kingston, they made similar comments about Punk in their promos. So either this is the greatest slow build to a heel turn that I have ever seen, or, and actually, I don't know if it'll be better than Brett in 97, but either this is going to be a long burn to a heel turn, or these men were right all along about CM Punk, and Punk really is not as well-liked as we would be led to believe that he is backstage. Things aren't as harmonious as AEW would like for everybody to believe that things are behind the scenes. We know FTR loves him. Maybe everybody else in the locker room isn't as fond of him as Dax and Cash. Evidently, Punk did not take kindly to those words and those promos that Hangman cut. I know in the go-home promo to Double or Nothing, Hangman brought up workers' rights and kind of threw that in Punk's face, and that was a strange thing for him to say. And then it was never mentioned again. But there's also the 800-pound elephant in the room that is Colt Cabana. We know the falling out those two had and what has happened to Colt since Punk arrived, and a lot of people in the company are not happy about it. You don't have to be a summa cum laude graduate to know that the reason Colt Cabana was excommunicated from the Dark Order and banished to Ring of Honor is because of CM Punk and Tony Khan wanting to make his biggest star happy. Tony Khan will bend over backwards to make CM Punk happy. He practically melted down during the post-show scrum after Double or Nothing when someone brought up comments that Eric Bischoff had made about Punk. So if Punk wanted Cabana gone, or if Tony thought that he and Colt sharing a locker room might make for an uncomfortable situation for Punk, who do you think he's going to move heaven and earth to please? I'm sure most of the locker room is not happy about the Cabana stuff. I know he's very well liked. The Young Bucks are very tight with him also, and they're EVPs in the company. In fact, Colt has said that after the EVPs, he was the only other person to know about the formation of AEW before it even became official. But per Fightful Select, this is what Fightful said. Punk defeated Hangman at Double or Nothing earlier this year before being forced away from the ring for several months. Before that, however, there was word that Punk and Hangman did not see eye to eye on some promo material that emerged on an episode of Dynamite that built to their match. Fightful has been told that it was to the point that CM Punk met with AEW higher-ups about the context of Paige's promo. Voices of Wrestling had noted that they had heard that Punk told others after the meeting in May that he would not lose to Hangman Page. The belief among several on the roster that we spoke with was that Punk believed Hangman went into business for himself, and that Punk may have seen the August 17th promo this week as a receipt. It is important to note that was locker room speculation as opposed to Punk telling anybody that directly. From Punk's end of things, the Hangman promo had alluded to Punk's issues with Colt Cabana and happened during a week where Punk was not at the show, while Punk's shot at Hangman happened with Hangman present. And Brian Alvarez on Wrestling Observer Live added this to the story. He said there were a few people furious at CM Punk backstage because Hangman is well-liked. So they're mad at Punk. Also, you have people who are on Punk's side who say Hangman started this. So they're mad that you're mad at CM Punk. It was started when Hangman was unprofessional, and CM Punk followed that up by making Hangman look like a fool. This sounds so juvenile. Well, he started it first, like a couple of fucking kids. Not good. Fightful took things even further by claiming that Punk has been expressing his displeasure behind the scenes so blatantly that some in AEW thought he might actually quit. CM Punk walking out on a company. I've never heard of such a thing. Fightful points out that they haven't been given any reason to believe that Punk would leave the company, but they have been told by one AEW veteran that they have heard threats have been levied, or that threats have been levied by Punk. I don't know what's real and what isn't with this story. Okay, nobody does. I don't think anybody who's reporting on this story in good faith, and there could be some good legitimate information in these stories. Again, we're talking about websites in some cases that I trust, that I look to as some of the more reliable ones in the wrestling community. Nobody knows for sure exactly what is going on. If it is all an elaborate work, it certainly has people talking. But if it is, then there are a lot of people in the back who have not been clued into that fact. And that's the sort of shit that WCW would do all the time. They would work the boys. And it created a very toxic, very distrustful environment behind the scenes. That is not what AEW needs. AEW does not need to become a second coming of WCW when it started to go down the fucking tubes. If it isn't a work, and Punk really is upset, I don't know what he has to be so upset about. From day one that he walked in the door, Tony Khan has rolled out the red carpet for this man. He went over on Darby Allin. He went over on Eddie Kingston. He ultimately went over on MJF. He went over on Hangman Page. He became the AEW World Champion. CM Punk has had a very charmed run so far outside of the injury that he himself caused. In the year that he has been in AEW, everything he hated about WWE, he has had the opposite in AEW. He has had freedom here that he did not have working for Vince McMahon, and a much easier road schedule, probably a lot more money. CM Punk is the last person who has anything to complain about in this company, at least as far as him and his creative and his character is concerned. Maybe he has issues with other aspects of Tony Khan's booking. Maybe that's frustrating to him. I don't know. But as far as CM Punk on CM Punk, he has nothing to complain about. He has nothing to be upset about. If Tony Khan fears that CM Punk could walk out on him, it's possible that that late decision to bump up the match with him and Moxley could be his way of getting the belt off Punk now, because things are starting to boil over and he doesn't want to take any chances. There is a very real possibility that Jon Moxley could walk out of Cleveland this week as the unified AEW World Champion. I don't think he will, but I also wouldn't dismiss it. Maybe there is no major angle plan. Maybe this was a panic move. Maybe he pushed the panic button. I mean, it was just thrown out there casually by Excalibur late in the show in the normal course of him speed reading through all of the match announcements that he does every week. It almost makes me wonder if the decision was made so late that it was made during the show, after the opening segment. And then they kind of said, okay, mention the fact that next week we're going to do the match then. You know, Dynamite this week averaged 957,000 overnight viewers on TBS. and the second lowest demo number since moving to TBS in January. If they can't do at least a million this week, and really they should do a lot more than a million viewers for their biggest match, if they can't do that this Wednesday, that is a very troublesome sign. 957,000 is not a bad number. But if you're going to put out CM Punk and Jon Moxley in a championship unification match on Dynamite this week, and you can't pull well over a million viewers, that's not good. You know, before all this stuff broke about bigger problems with Punk, you know, when I thought it was just about Punk giving Hangman a receipt for what he said about him before, I didn't have any issue with it. I think it creates some drama and tension on the shows. I think it makes the shows more interesting. If Hangman got punked out this week, then you know what? The next time he gets a live mic on TV, I think he should give it right back to CM Punk. Not everybody needs to be best friends, singing fucking Kumbaya in the back and roasting marshmallows together. But if there's bigger issues with Punk and he's cranky because he hasn't had his diaper changed, the best thing for Tony Khan to do is to get these guys in a room together to air this shit out before it gets out of hand, and then we end up with the Chicago screwjob. You know, when you're dealing with a lot of egos, it's a delicate thing. There's a time to be a fan and a cheerleader for these people, as Tony Khan is, and a time to step up and be a leader. And if this is not a work, and the tensions here are very real, it's time to step up and lead. Because you don't want this to spiral out of control. That's the last thing you want. Especially at a time when WWE has all of this momentum. Oh, Triple H has taken over. And Triple H, of course, worked with all these people in NXT. And they love him and they sing his praises. And now they're more open to coming to WWE or coming back to WWE. The pendulum might be swinging the other way now. This is the worst time for something like this to be happening. Wouldn't it be something if what Hangman said about Punk turns out to be true, about him having to protect AEW from him? I don't know if it's art imitating life or life imitating art. I would hope that isn't the case. And it would be a hell of an angle if this was all designed to lead to a CM Punk heel turn. Maybe it was engineered that way from the start. With all of the comments about, you know, Punk from all of his other opponents playing into it, all to build to this moment, 1 year after his arrival, where the veil is lifted, the mask comes off to reveal the real CM Punk. And it's MJF, of all people, returning to be the savior of AEW. What a payoff that would be. Punk's feud with Kingston, his feud with MJF, his feud with Hangman, nearly all of his opponents, they told us, they told the fans, he is not what he pretends to be. What if the payoff is that they were all telling the truth? And Tony Khan has to rely on MJF now in storyline to save his company. Now that's a story. And for AEW's sake, I hope that's all it is. Kenny Omega made his return to the ring for the first time in 9 months on Dynamite as the mystery partner for the Young Bucks, advancing to the next round of the Trios Championship Tournament over Andrade, Rush, and Dragon Lee. He did not look like a man who was 100%, but I think that was part of the whole, you know, design of the match. Telling the story that Omega is not fully healed yet, he's not 100%. Can he and the Bucks make it all the way to the finals in this tournament? They're going to meet the winners of Death Triangle against Will Ospreay and Aussie Open this week. And I am thinking some combination of Sting, Darby Allin, and or Miro end up costing the House of Black their match with the Dark Order. We already saw Miro come out and beat up Buddy Matthews on Rampage on Friday. So he's made it his mission to take down all the members of the House of Black. I think we're headed for an Elite against Dark Order final, given Hangman's involvement with the Dark Order. And I think we'll get Sting, Darby, and Miro against House of Black at All Out. Bryan Danielson beat Daniel Garcia 2-1 in an excellent 2 out of 3 falls match. Almost 30 minutes they gave these two. Garcia lost nothing in defeat. He actually had people chanting, "You're a wrestler," at him when this was over. Since he goes around now with Jericho calling himself a sports entertainer, they were chanting, "You're a wrestler." They wanted him, they wanted him to go to the Blackpool Combat Club. And there was some drama after the match when he pulled Chris Jericho off of Danielson. So the match with Danielson and Jericho at All Out, which hasn't been announced yet, but it will be, looks like it's going to be a battle for the soul of Daniel Garcia. It's like a custody battle. Now, over on Raw and SmackDown, I want to just talk briefly about some of the things that we saw this week. No surprise returns on Raw this week. Triple H, he calmed himself for a week. He's slowing things down before the next big return, whether it's Bray Wyatt or Johnny Gargano or whoever. A lot of names being floated around. Gargano, I think, is inevitable. But we got three matches of 15 minutes or longer on Monday night, which is something, frankly, that should never be an issue on a three-hour show. You can have some long matches on these shows. And they did. We had Drew McIntyre against Kevin Owens. We had Bobby Lashley and AJ Styles for the United States Championship. We had Austin Theory, who was back on TV this week in the main event, no less, taking on Dolph Ziggler. As McIntyre said in his promo, he had this great fiery promo on Kevin Owens on Monday, "We're wrestlers in a wrestling ring." And he's right. At the end of the day, that's what it's all about. Wrestlers in a wrestling ring. It is all about wrestling. That was the key word this week. They're in Toronto for Raw tomorrow night with Trish Stratus making an appearance. I hope the Toronto crowd is as loud as the Montreal crowd was on Friday. One of the best wrestling cities in the world. The 1200th episode of SmackDown was the Sami Zayn show. They were in his hometown. He was the hometown hero. And we got our first backstage segment, our first backstage interaction between Sami Zayn and Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns was all by himself this week. There was no Paul Heyman. He's still licking his wounds from SummerSlam. The Usos could not get over the border because, of course, they've got some legal issues that prevent them from coming into the country. So the Usos were never going to be on the show. So Roman showed up by himself, and it was just him and Sammy sitting on a couch in the back in Roman's locker room. And this was fucking gold. That is what this was. And I'll say this. I compared it a little bit to Austin and Angle the other night. This could be to this era, if they want to drag this on, you know, for longer, this could be to this era what Rock and Sock was over 20 years ago with Rock and Mankind. Or Steve Austin and Kurt Angle and some of the comedy stuff they did in 2001. These two on screen together are gold. And this was just the first segment. Imagine if we can get even more of these. You know, Roman Reigns, clearly in storyline, you look at his facial expressions and just the way the whole bloodline has been treating Sami Zayn, they're using him. They're stringing him along. They're using him. He's a useful idiot to them. But you could go so many different ways with this. Maybe Roman Reigns ends up liking Sami. Maybe he ends up respecting him. Maybe he tells the Usos, you need to be more like him. He's willing to go out there and take one for the team. He took a fucking Claymore kick at the end of SmackDown on Friday. He took a bullet for Roman at the end of the show. Is that something Jimmy or Jay would have done? Probably not. Maybe he does in the end up gaining some respect for this guy. Maybe they'll be tag team champions one day. I mean, there's so many different ways that you could go with this. It would almost be a shame for them to kill it now. Drag this out a little bit longer. But the interplay between them was so fantastic. And Sammy was part of a fatal five-way to crown a new number one contender for the Intercontinental Championship. Another week with more emphasis on the secondary titles. The U.S. title on Raw with that great, the battle between Lashley and AJ Styles. They're continuing to feature that title in a prominent position every week. Right around that 10 p.m. hour, which is the peak, the ratings peak usually of the shows. Even Corey Graves said that on his podcast this week. He said, I'm going to give you a little inside baseball. He was talking about why certain things are positioned in certain times during the show. 10 p.m. now is like the peak for Monday Night Raw. Of course it is. If the show is 8 to 10, the end of the show would be the peak. Where it falls off a cliff is when you have the third hour because the show is too fucking long. But we've been over this a million times. But on SmackDown, they put this match together because they wanted to crown a number one contender for the IC title. And it was Sami Zayn, it was Happy Corbin, it was Ricochet, it was Madcap Moss, and it was Sheamus. And these guys went out there for 22 minutes, and they had an excellent match. Now, obviously, Sami was the big baby face. They wanted him to win. I mean, that reaction he got when he came out, that entrance on Friday was just fucking great. he felt like the biggest star in the world. And it was cool. I had a smile on my face watching it because Sammy has been, he's just been so great. No matter what they give him to do, whether it's as a babyface, whether it's as a heel, whether, you know, the comedy stuff with the Jackass guys, the whole storyline with the documentary, with the conspiracy theory stuff, the stuff now with the Bloodline, Sami Zayn knocks it out of the fucking park every single time, no matter what they give to him. And I hope that at the end of all of this, whenever that may be, whether it's the end of the Bloodline storyline, whether he goes babyface, whether it's a big WrestleMania match, whatever it may be, I hope there's some kind of big payoff for him in the end of this. I don't know if he'll be the world champion, but he deserves it. He really is one of the unsung, and now people are singing his praises more, but he really is one of the MVPs of this company, bar none. But so is Sheamus. Sheamus is more of an unsung MVP than Sami Zayn is, because everybody, I think, has been loving the Sami Zayn stuff. Sheamus is another one who I think doesn't get enough appreciation for being as consistent as he is in this company, in the ring. He was in there in that match. It was a great match. Sheamus picks up the win, and I had a smile from ear to ear, because, of course, the match that I've been pitching for Clash at the Castle just became a reality. Walter is going to defend his Intercontinental title at Cardiff's Clash of the Castle, one-on-one, against Sheamus. First time ever. Sheamus and Walter one-on-one. That is automatically the match I am looking most forward to now on this show. I don't expect there to be a title change. And I do think down the road, Sheamus could be the one to take that title from Walter. I think it would be premature for him to do it now. You know, but there's definitely a story there where it's the one title Sheamus hasn't had that he's clamoring for. He must be the Intercontinental Champion. And he will be. But I don't know that it's going to be in Cardiff. But that's going to be a hell of a fucking match. My body hurts just thinking about what these two are going to do to each other in that ring. They're going to beat the living piss out of each other. But it makes me wonder, you know, one person we haven't seen on television, I think, at all since Triple H took over. Or maybe once briefly, but Pete Dunne. Where's Butch? Right? We haven't heard about Butch. And I've been hoping that Triple H maybe is intentionally keeping him away so that they can bring him back as Pete Dunne. Drop the Butch stuff. Let him be Pete Dunne. There's a way to do that here. It almost feels like Sheamus may be headed towards a babyface turn himself. I mean, forget Sami Zayn for a second. Sheamus could be headed that way as well. I could see a situation here. I'm just looking ahead now to this match. These two go in there, they have this great battle, right? Walter ends up retaining the Intercontinental title. Well, here comes Butch and Ridge Holland. And they beat the hell out of Sheamus when the match is over because he failed. He was supposed to bring the Intercontinental belt back to the Brawling Brutes and he failed. So they beat the hell out of him. But it's no longer Butch. They bring back Pete Dunne. They can use that as a way to bring back Pete Dunne. That's what I would do. If you don't change the title, there's a story there. They beat up Sheamus after. I mean, it breaks up the group, but hey, then we can get Pete Dunne and Sheamus matches on TV. But that would be an easy way to drop the Butch bullshit. But the other thing coming out of SmackDown that also put a smile on my face, to go back to Sami Zayn for a second, is Roman Reigns bringing up Kevin Owens when he was in the back with Sami. And he said, you know, you're still tight with KO, right? Because on Raw Monday night, Kevin Owens sent a message to the Usos, who tried to get, well, they didn't try, they got involved in the match with McIntyre and Owens. It led to a DQ finish, and after Owens laid out McIntyre with a stunner, he looked over at the Usos on the outside and says, hey, tell Roman he owes me one, and then he walked off. And so Roman tells Sammy, you're still tight with that Kevin Owens guy, right? Well, good, I want you to deliver a message for me. You let Kevin Owens know that I don't owe him anything ever. And Sammy was, you know, playing it off like, well, you know, we haven't talked in a hot minute and we're not really that tight at the moment. I'm on SmackDown, he's on Raw, but yeah, I know the guy. Sure. I'll let him know. What I loved about it is, there it is, right? There's the opening now to put them together on TV, get the interaction going with Owens and Zayn. Owens can try to tell Sammy, look, these guys don't give a fuck about you. It's the story I mapped out last week. They're stringing you along. They're using you. They don't care about you. You're not a member of the Bloodline. You never were a member of the Bloodline. Stop calling them Oos. You're not their Oos. right? And Sammy's in denial. But at the end of all of this, Sammy has this coming to Jesus moment and he realizes what's going on here. And it all builds to Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn taking the tag team titles from the Usos. We've been looking at this tag team division now for months, trying to figure out who is it going to be? What is the team that is going to come along and take these championships away from the Usos? They've already beaten the Street Profits. They're done. That's it. That story is over. The New Day, that's been done to death. And the New Day, they're off doing something else. There's nobody else. There is nobody else prepared and ready right now. Not the Vikings, not the Alpha Academy, nobody who is ready to step up and be that team after 300 some odd days to take those titles from the Usos. Except Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, who aren't even a team right now. But there's a built-in story with Sami. And the way that Jey Uso has been treating him and yelling at him and disrespecting him, the story is right there. It's so great. And I hope they take it. I'm hopeful after what they did on Friday that they're thinking the same thing. Triple H is thinking along the same lines. So I loved everything that Sami Zayn was involved in on Friday. I loved all of it. And I can see now where this story is going, and I think it's fucking great. So anyway, that was Raw and SmackDown. Some other news and notes to get into here. The Wall Street Journal on Wednesday confirmed that the $5 million in additional payments I talked about last week made by Vince McMahon that should have been recorded as company expenses and were not, were indeed made to the Donald Trump Foundation, which no longer exists. They were made in exchange for Trump's appearance at WrestleMania 23 in the Battle of the Billionaires and for the quickly aborted storyline where Trump bought Monday Night Raw and then Wall Street flipped out because they thought it was real. And so they had to come out and say, no, it's just a storyline. And a week or two later, the whole fucking thing was over. Because those payments benefited the company, WWE's own attorney said that they should have been booked as business expenses and they were not. The contract with Trump stipulated that McMahon would send $4 million, a $4 million appearance fee, to Trump's foundation while Trump went around bragging about being bonused an additional $1 million because of how successful that year's WrestleMania was. And it was. It's still to this day the biggest money match in WrestleMania history was the whole Battle of the Billionaires thing and the whole build-up with Vince and Trump. Jerry McDevitt, though, WWE's own attorney, Vince McMahon's longtime attorney, he called bullshit on that claim from Trump and pointed out that clearly Trump entered a contract with WWE before WrestleMania that year, which clearly stated that he would be paid an appearance fee of $1 million, while Vince and Linda made a personal contribution to Trump's foundation. And that no additional fee was paid to Trump after the fact because the show was so successful. The funniest part of this story, though, isn't even that. It's that Trump had his associates review the contract to make sure that under no circumstances would Vince McMahon be allowed to shave his head, even if Mr. and I quote now, even if Mr. Trump's wrestler dropped dead in the ring. So if poor Bobby Lashley had a heart attack in the middle of his match with Umaga, and he died in the middle of the ring at Ford Field, Trump was going to make damn sure that his hair was safe. Fuck Bobby Lashley. I want to make sure my hair is safe. As if they were going to hogtie him to a chair against his will and shave his head. You cannot make this shit up. But I got a good laugh out of that. In another sign of change in WWE under Triple H, it appears that talent can once again stream and post content to their YouTube and Twitch channels. Early last year, there was a whole lot of, we covered it here, whole lot of controversy around Vince McMahon banning talent from third-party platforms like Twitch and Cameo. I don't know what the status of Cameo is, but the idea was that the company wanted them to either shut them down, either just shut down your accounts, or hand over control to us. Give us the login, give us the password. We will control the account so that we can make money off of them. And the wrestler would then receive a portion of the income generated from that person's channel, which would be deducted from their downside guarantee. And there were a lot of people in the company who were very upset about this, and some were publicly vocal. Paige probably was the most vocal of anybody. She says, I'm not giving up my Twitch, I don't give a fuck. Paige now is out of the company. although I'm not saying one has to do with the other, but her contract ran out, they didn't renew, and now Paige is no longer with WWE. Drew Gulak posted a tweet on Thursday that he later deleted, announcing that he was returning to Twitch, and he thanked, quote, Papa H for the chance to do so. And he was on Twitch, I think, later that night for over 2 hours. I think I saw where Dakota Kai said that she would be able to stream again on Twitch, even though she's, you know, she's back now under contract with WWE, that she would be able to keep twitching, I guess. I guess that would be the phrase. She can keep twitching. And the one that I'm actually very excited about, Sheamus posted a brand new video on his Celtic Warrior Workouts channel. He's got an entire channel devoted to these Celtic Warrior workouts. He's got like 730,000 subscribers on there. And he posted a very quick video clip a few days ago announcing that after a 2-year hiatus, the workouts would be coming back. I put his channel over on the podcast once, a long time ago. Basically what it is, he would go around and he would film these, and they could be 30 minutes, they could be an hour. You know, these long workout videos, it starts with like a 10 to 20 minute interview where he's just standing around talking to and interviewing the person. And after they're done talking, they go into whatever that person's workout is. He wants to go around doing other people's workouts to see if he can do it. And he would have everybody. I mean, he did one with John Cena. He did one with Edge. All different wrestlers from the roster and even, I think, his father was in one, and, you know, sometimes there's non-wrestling people. But they were great. I remember the one he did with Edge. I think he went to go where Edge lives in North Carolina somewhere, and they were doing, this before Edge came back, and they went biking. And Sheamus, I think, yeah, he's got, like, the GoPro on, so you can see as they're riding down, like, this fucking mountain or whatever. And Edge, he must have hit, like, a log or something. I don't know. Maybe, you know, I have no idea. You know, he ran into Kevin Dunn's house. Whatever it is, he went ass over tea kettle over this fucking thing. He took a hell of a bump. And then he was like, no, I'm okay. I actually think it was after that he realized he was okay taking a bump. And eventually, that may have been part of what led to him coming back. But a lot of great videos on that channel. And I was really sad when all of a sudden they stopped, which I think was around the time that they put this stupid fucking policy into place. So all of a sudden this video pops up a few days ago from Sheamus saying, guess what, everybody? You know, the workouts are coming back. There has been no official word on this from WWE. Now, they don't have to make an announcement about this. This is more of an internal kind of employee or talent thing. You know, they didn't publicly announce the first time that they were banning all of this stuff, so I don't know why they would make, you know, a public announcement now. But all of the evidence that we're seeing suggests that Triple H is taking a different approach than his father-in-law did. And that's a good thing. Charlotte Flair was the guest on Steve Austin's Broken Skull Sessions this week. I thought this was one of the harder ones to watch. It wasn't a bad interview, but it was hard to sit through parts of it because she was having a lot of trouble finding the words that she wanted to use for a lot of her answers. Her and Austin didn't really seem to be on the right, you know, on the same page a lot. Once you get past those moments, though, you do get some interesting insight into how her mind works and just little things in her matches that she wishes she could go back and change and do better. You know, as they were watching clips of her various matches with Ronda Rousey and Asuka and Becky Lynch, she said the match with Ronda at Survivor Series is her favorite one. But at the time, she saw it as, I'm losing my WrestleMania spot. Because everybody believed that the WrestleMania main event the following year, the first ever women's main event of WrestleMania, was going to be Charlotte and Ronda, one-on-one. And then a little something happened, which was this lady named Becky Lynch ended up becoming super over. And it kind of threw all of those plans into chaos. But what happened is Becky was going to wrestle Ronda at Survivor Series. The plan was never for Becky to go to WrestleMania and do anything with Ronda. They were going to do it at Survivor Series. And then Becky had her face broken by Nia Jax. And Charlotte was the backup. And in her mind, it's like, oh, great, I just lost my Mania spot. So they did the match in November, and it was a great match. It was an excellent match they had. Better than the WrestleMania match. Austin asked for her thoughts on Sasha, and Naomi walking out. She was very diplomatic about it. She was very careful not to pick sides. She said she didn't know the whole story. But she did say that she would find it very hard to imagine never getting back into the ring with Sasha again. She called Sasha her Ricky Steamboat, as Steamboat was to her father. That's what Ric Flair calls Sasha Banks. She's Charlotte's Ricky Steamboat. She also said that she wishes more people understood when she is on television in an angle that people don't like, or if she's shoehorned into something, that she doesn't come up with her creative herself. Yet she gets all the heat for it, so you could tell that bothered her. She wishes that they would have come up with a storyline reason for her being inserted into the WrestleMania 35 main event other than just, she's Charlotte Flair, and so she should be in the match. She thought, just put a segment in the show that showed her backstage, you know, lobbying to get into the match and manipulating, you know, playing politics or something. So at least that she could lean into that as a heel, but they didn't do any of that. The most laughable part of this, though, was when they showed the infamous title belt swap with her and Becky last year after the draft, when Charlotte dropped the belt on the mat. She said, I wish I could sit here and tell you that I did it on purpose. But if people need me to be the bad guy, I'll be that bad guy. She said, things happen on screen. I would never go on a scripted television show and purposefully do something on purpose. It was an accident. She claims dropping the belt on the ground was an accident. Yes. Accidentally on purpose. And the 32nd annual G1 Climax is in the books, and the Rainmaker takes it for the second year in a row. Last year, it was a ref stoppage when Kota Ibushi got hurt in the finals, and very anticlimactic win for Okada. This was his fourth win overall in the G1. That puts him just one win behind Masahiro Chono for the all-time record dating back to the very first G1 Climax in 1991. If you count all of the tournaments that came prior to that, which had different names, they were not called the G1 Climax back then Antonio Inoki would hold the record with 10 wins, and there ain't nobody reaching that record anytime soon. Although Okada is young enough where he could one day actually tie or break that record. He's still young enough where he could pull that off, but nobody is beating Inoki's record anytime soon. On Sound Off 765, I'm not one to toot my own horn. I don't go around patting myself on the back. If I did, I'd have arthritis in my shoulder. But on Sound Off 765, I predicted that Okada and Will Ospreay would go to the finals this year with Okada winning the entire thing. And that's exactly what happened. You know, this is the 50th anniversary for New Japan Pro Wrestling. And it is Okada's 10-year anniversary since he came back from excursion and became a real star. It made all the sense in the world that he would be the one to go over. They go with their tried and true for the Tokyo Dome main event, especially at a time when business is not as good as it used to be. The product is a lot colder than it was even just a couple of years ago. The only thing I got wrong, I said he would beat Jay White in the semis, and he beat Tama Tonga instead. But I did say the other semifinal would come down to Ospreay and Naito. Ospreay would go over, and that's exactly what happened. Naito, by the way, Naito just feels dead as a top guy right now. I mean, there's just it's a weird thing. I know he still has a lot of fans, and they get very upset when he's not doing anything. It just feels to me like he's done as a top guy right now in New Japan. But the final match with Okada and Ospreay was just tremendous. They went 34 minutes, just shy of the all-time G1 record. The story was Ospreay throwing everything at Okada to try to beat him cleanly for the first time. The only win he has over Okada involved cheating. It involved deception. It involved shenanigans. He was trying to beat the guy straight up here. He used moves from past opponents of Okada's. He hit Tanahashi's high fly flow. Couldn't put him away. He hit the Styles Clash. Couldn't put him away. He hit Kenny Omega's V-Trigger. He tried for the One-Winged Angel. Ospreay did kick out of one Rainmaker clothesline, but a second one later on did him in. It sucks that the fans still are not allowed to do anything but clap on these shows, because they would have been going nuts for this. They announced that Wrestle Kingdom is going back to a one-night-only format on January 4th. At the Tokyo Dome, they're bringing back their New Year Dash show on January 5th. They started the two-night format in 2020. And last year, the event was three nights, although the third night wasn't at the Tokyo Dome. It was held in a smaller building a few nights later. That was New Japan against Pro Wrestling Noah, so I guess that was just a one-off. They're not doing that again this year. New Japan was a lot hotter 3 years ago when they started with the two-night format than it is today, post-pandemic. I think that's safe to say. They were not going to be able to fill the Tokyo Dome up enough back-to-back nights, so it makes sense to go back to the old format. Hopefully, though, they keep the show within a reasonable length. It's not going to be 6 hours long. Meltzer says that some AEW stars are expected to be on the show. I would think FTR would have to be a given. They're the IWGP Tag Team Champions. So I would think FTR make their Tokyo Dome debut this year. Bryan Danielson has made it very clear he wants to wrestle there, but only when fans are allowed to cheer and boo. We have no idea when that's going to be. So, is he on the show? Is he not on the show? I think he definitely could be on the show. The other name to watch for, though, is going to be Kenny Omega. The last time Omega wrestled at the Tokyo Dome was his grand finale with New Japan. It was his loss to Tanahashi at Wrestle Kingdom 13. He and Will Ospreay have been exchanging words now for months. This week on Dynamite, Ospreay and Aussie Open, they wrestled Death Triangle in the Trios title tournament. The winners of that match will go on to meet Omega and the Bucks in the next round. I don't think New Japan is sending these three here to get bounced out of the opening round. I think United Empire wins, and we get a preview of Omega and Ospreay in the semifinals on TV. Then we get a singles match between the two of them, and it's going to be at one of two places. We either get Omega against Ospreay at Grand Slam next month at Arthur Ashe Stadium, or at the Tokyo Dome in January. That is my prediction. We are going to get a one-on-one match. It is going to be either in September in Queens, or it's going to be in January at the Tokyo Dome. You have to save that match for a big building. That is my prediction. One of those two shows. New Japan also announced its return to New York City for the first time since they sold out Madison Square Garden with Ring of Honor. It'll take place Friday night, October 28th, not at the Hammerstein Ballroom like they were hoping for, but at the Palladium in Times Square for a pay-per-view that they are calling Rumble on 44th Street. The ticket on sale is this Thursday at 10 a.m. The pre-sale starts tomorrow. You can use the code RUMBLE. So if you want to, that's the code. Good luck. The show will include wrestlers from Stardom, so maybe Kyrie will be on the show. They've already announced the crowning of the first ever IWGP Women's Champion. That's going to be taking place in Tokyo on November 20th. I think once that happens, that title is going to be defended a lot here in the States. Now, I've been watching all of these A&E biographies. Did a whole recap and review on the Lex Luger one last week. I got some good feedback from that, so thank you for that. I was actually thinking about skipping the D-Generation X one, because I've heard the story so many times already. But I watched it. I thought it was a fine crash course in what DX was, if you are new to this, if you are a new fan, if you're not a fan. Otherwise, you don't really get much out of this that you didn't already hear a thousand times, other than how bad things got personally for a lot of them, because they did interview Billy Gunn and Road Dogg and Sean and all the key players, except China, for obvious reasons. So they do cover all of that stuff. And they have a lot of the key talking heads are all interviewed for this. They talked about the Click to start things out before they even got into the DX stuff. Because to have an understanding of DX, you must first know about the friendship and the relationship between these men. And you must know what the Click is. And they talked about the Click. They talked about Scott Hall and Kevin Nash leaving for WCW. And they covered the curtain call at Madison Square Garden. They have curtain calls on Broadway every single night. I guarantee you there has never been a curtain call talked about as much as this one. Triple H admits that he was supposed to win the King of the Ring tournament in 1996, and because Scott and Kevin left, and Shawn was the champion, all of the heat for the curtain call at MSG when they all hugged in the middle of the ring, all of the heat fell upon him. And Vince McMahon told him famously, "You're going to have to learn to eat shit and like the taste of it," which is what he did for the next 6 months. One interesting takeaway from all of this, and I don't recall them ever admitting to this in any of the other documentaries I've seen, is that Shawn Michaels losing his smile in February of 1997 and dropping the WWF title had nothing to do with his phony knee injury. Triple H flat out says in this episode, his addiction problems were so bad by that point, he had to step away or he was going to die. Now, I don't know if that means he went to rehab during that time. He wasn't gone for very long. He was back on television probably a month later, prancing around. I mean, he wasn't wrestling until I think late April or sometime in May. But by mid-March, he was already making appearances on TV. At WrestleMania, he was doing commentary for the main event. He was moving around pretty good for a guy who had such a potentially devastating career-ending knee injury. So I don't know if he ever actually went to rehab during that period or what. They didn't say. But the whole knee injury or the severity of the... Yeah, I could buy maybe he had a minor knee injury, but the whole severity of the knee injury, I've been saying it for years, complete and total bullshit. The guy was a mess. And he did not want to drop the belt. Plain and simple. That's all it ever was. So it was nice to hear them finally admit to it. And not just say, oh, he had a career-ending knee injury, a potentially career-ending knee injury. No, he was all fucked up and he didn't want to lose, so then he lost his smile. DX is formed later in 97. I saw the Jim Cornette clip. There was a clip floating around from Cornette's show this week where he was running down... Because anything with Cornette and Vince Russo that I see, I gotta listen to this, right? So there's a whole clip where Cornette is running down a list of Vince Russo creative ideas that Russo had written down and had pitched or was going to pitch to Vince McMahon. Cornette kept, because Cornette and Russo were both part of the creative team in WWE at that time. So Cornette kept all of his notes over the course of his career. He has every payoff he ever made in what town it was in, the date, what the gate was, what the attendance was. He's like a savant with this stuff. The man basically has an entire museum of stuff in his house. But I heard this clip, and he says that it was Russo, at the end of this long list of mostly terrible ideas, who pitched the idea of Shawn Michaels and Triple H as a clique of their own on camera. You know, you would see them goofing off behind the scenes, and his thing was, let them do that on camera, and call themselves the Elite. Which is hilarious, looking back on it now, all these years later, now we have, you know, a group that calls themselves the Elite. Russo said that they can call themselves the Elite, and you can put Road Dogg and Billy Gunn with them. Now, I also heard all the other ideas that Russo pitched, like having the Patriot turn heel and become a Japanese sympathizer and link up with Yokozuna, the Samoan who pretended to be Japanese. Some of these ideas were, or Yokozuna would join the Hart Foundation. Some of these ideas were just, my God. I can see why it was so important to have McMahon there as the filter for Russo, so he could take some of the few really good ideas and separate them out from all the terrible ones that he got pitched. So anyway, DX is formed in late 97. It appears to be a Russo idea. Just to let them go out there and be themselves. It's not like Russo was reinventing the wheel. He's like, just take these two together and let them do the shit on camera. It'll get over on its own. And Sean's problems are well documented in this episode, and they got very bad. And I've heard the stories before about Triple H having to be his caretaker on the road and his babysitter and to watch after him. And there were many nights where Triple H would have to physically carry Sean to his hotel room, put him in bed, take off, you know, his clothes and make sure that his head was elevated so that he wouldn't vomit and choke on his own vomit. And he would check back on him periodically to make sure that he wasn't, you know, choking and he was breathing and alive. And I mean, think about this. This is what life on the road was for Triple H for a period of months, you know, when Shawn was at his worst. One of the key takeaways from this episode is just how fucked up everybody was, except for Triple H. Triple H was the straight edge guy when it came to the recreational drugs and the alcohol. He was the designated driver of this group. He was the one guy who kept his nose clean and never had any problems. He never had to go to rehab. He never went out on live TV high as a kite or slurring his speech or anything like that. He was the one member of DX who was not a complete and total embarrassment. Even as far back as 97, he was sitting in on production meetings. Vince McMahon let him sit in. In the episode, Triple H at one point was talking about being on a creative call. This would have been in 98. That's what he was doing. This guy clearly had designs on much bigger things, even going back 25 years. He had much higher aspirations. Meanwhile, he's doing this. All these other clowns, they're out partying and popping pills, making jackasses out of themselves, while Triple H is plotting his takeover. He was playing the long game. Only now is it really finally starting to pay off. But Triple H ended up taking over DX. Shawn, of course, had the back injury. You know what was really alarming to see? They had the highlights of the WrestleMania 14 press conference. And at the dais, you have Steve Austin, you have Shawn Michaels, you have Mike Tyson. Triple H is standing behind Shawn. And you look at Shawn. Look at how bloated his face is. So you can tell he was definitely on stuff. And he was not healthy. He just doesn't look healthy. He's not healthy at all. And so that's when his problems got really bad. He gutted through the WrestleMania match with Steve Austin. And then he was going to go away and he was going to have back surgery. And he did not have back surgery right away. He tried to just rehab it on his own. He ultimately ended up having back surgery. So now it's the night after WrestleMania. And Triple H is in the ring for one of the most important promos of his entire career. Because now Triple H is going to take over as the de facto leader of D-Generation X. Right now there is no DX anymore. It's Triple H in China. Shawn is gone. Triple H is out there. And then he introduces Shawn Waltman, who debuts as X-Pac. And that was huge. As somebody who was watching all of this at the time and flipping between the shows, but I was more of a WWF guy, to see Waltman walk out there. Waltman may not have been a name on the level of a Hulk Hogan or even a Hall or Nash or a Lex Luger. All these big names that would pop up on TV, on Raw and Nitro. He wasn't on that level. But he was the first major defection from WCW back to WWE. Usually it was going the opposite way. This was the first real statement like, wow, the pendulum looks like it may be swinging back the other way now. And I don't know that the second version of DX works without Waltman being part of that group. And then later that night, they added the New Age Outlaws. So in the span of just a couple of hours, DX went from two people, one of whom was a manager, to this whole brand new faction under the leadership of Triple H. And there have been many different incarnations of DX over the years. You have the original trio with China. You have the Triple H-led version in 98. You have the McMahon-Helmsley era version of the group in 2000 with Tori and Stephanie. You have the reunion in 2006 with Hunter and Shawn and all the little DX reunions they tried to milk every fucking penny out of in the years that followed. Me personally, I have always been partial to that first Triple H-led version of DX in 98. That's my favorite version of DX. It's not the original. It's the one that came right after Shawn left, which is weird because Shawn Michaels is really the biggest member of DX. You know, the biggest and best member of DX was Shawn Michaels, the guy who effectively founded it. He created it. But I have always liked the second version of DX more than I have the first. Their feud with The Nation, Triple H's feud with The Rock, a lot of their, you know, some of the funnier stuff they did on TV. I thought all of that was great. It was very entertaining. One of the things they did, and they do cover it here in the episode, was the DX invasion of WCW Monday Nitro outside the Norfolk Scope in April of 98. So this was the same month. No, I'm sorry, it was the following month. After this new DX is formed, about a month later, is when this all happened. WCW was running Norfolk for Nitro. WWE was running Hampton, Virginia. It was West Virginia, I think. They were running Hampton for Raw, which is maybe, I looked it up, it's maybe 10 or 15 miles away. They weren't running very far, because in the special, Triple H says, oh, they're right down the block. So I looked it up. I said, they're not right down the block. I looked it up. I think it's about 10 or 15 miles. They were not very far from each other, is the point. And they came up with this idea to roll a tank down the street right outside of the scope to try to get into the building. they were going to try to do a literal invasion of Nitra. And they got out, and they got a tank, and they had a bullhorn, and this is the sort of thing they would absolutely not be able to get away with today. It was a very different world back then, riding a fucking tank down the street. They got out of the tank, they were talking to all the fans outside the building, all the Nitro fans, they were getting them to say, oh, we got our tickets for free to the show tonight, and they were asking him, who'd you really come to see? And they said, we came to see DX, and they got him to chant Bischoff sucks. And these are the people who were there to go to Nitro, right? So it was great. And they filmed all of this to put on Raw, and it was brilliant. But what would have been even more brilliant is if Eric Bischoff, when they rolled up to the building, would have actually let them in when they were asking to be let into the building. Instead, they had the gate come down to block them from getting into the building. Bischoff could have had an army of guys standing there on the other side of that gate, even with fucking pipes in their hand, not that they needed them, just waiting. And DX, I mean, they probably would have had these looks on their faces that would have been fucking priceless, like, oh shit. He didn't even need to have an army. He could have just had Meng standing there, and that would have been the end of DX. Meng and Scott Norton, just position them right in front of the gate. But really, what would they have done? They weren't going to do anything. Bischoff could have called their bluff, and it would have made for great TV. He could have aired it on Nitro that night and said the DX guys backed down like little, you know, cowards. Now, this was all filmed earlier in the day before the show started. This did not happen when Nitro was live on the air, but that's not how Eric Bischoff tells the story in this episode. I guess he felt the comment that he made on the Goldberg episode about Goldberg's match with Bret Hart from Starrcade. That didn't make him look bad enough. So let's shovel even more bullshit onto the mound. And Bischoff now is like, oh man, you know, I wish I didn't know, because I was in the ring on live television doing a promo with Hogan. I had no idea that any of this was happening. And the timeline doesn't really make a whole lot of sense there. But that's the story that Bischoff now tells. Oh man, yeah, I should have let them in. It would have been great. We would have put it on our show. But I just, you know, I was in the ring and I just didn't know. It was some other guy who pulled the gate down. Give me a fucking break. Triple H made the comment as time went on that, you know, there's a need for a Darth Vader in this company. We have Stone Cold, we have The Rock, right? Two huge baby faces. We don't have that one really big heel. And he wanted to be that guy. He wanted to be the Darth Vader in this company. Because he's smart enough to know that would have been a very lucrative position for him to be in. He'd get to work with all these guys. So he pitched it to Vince. The idea of going heel and DX coming to an end. And Vince went for it. This did not go over very well with the other members of DX. They were perfectly content to keep DX going. They were very happy. Waltman said they were making six figures on their quarterly merchandise checks. And he said, look, dude, go heel if you want, whatever, but don't affect our money. But Triple H's goals were much bigger than DX. They were bigger than just being stuck in this group for the next 5 or 10 years. He wanted to be the guy. He wanted to be the champion. You know, it's not like a New Day thing where those guys have been together for like 7 or 8 years now. Right? New Day will never break up. Now, Kofi and Big E, they eventually did become WWE champion. But that's not what Triple H saw for himself. Being stuck in this group or wanting to be part of this one group for the next 3 or 5 years. He wanted to branch out on his own and become this mega heel. And then they covered the downfall of all the other DX members, not named Triple H. X-Pac refusing to go to rehab for a muscle relaxer problem that he had. And Road Dogg getting fired for his drug problems. Billy got fired. China's issues. They glossed over a lot of the China stuff. They mentioned her. And they did have clips from her mother talking about how she was when she was growing up and all that. But the China stuff was really not dwelled on. Road Dogg talked about doing the Voodoo Kin Mafia stuff with Billy when they both went to TNA, and Triple H said, you know, people would come up to me and ask me, like, hey, did you hear what Brian and Billy said about you? Did you see that interview? They buried you. And Triple H said he would tell these people, like, guys, they're on drugs. They're popping pills. Like, you know, they're not in their right frame of mind. I remember that, by the way, not just the TNA promos. It was the I think it was an RF video shoot where they really just went all in and just buried Triple H. But if you think about it, you look at DX. The real prime run for DX was actually really short. It lasted less than 2 years before Triple H turned heel at WrestleMania 15. And took China with him, and they went to the, you know, they joined the corporate ministry. And look, they had a huge impact. The crotch chopping is something a lot of celebrities and athletes started doing because it was the cool thing to do, and DX was the cool thing at the time. I'm not denying the influence of DX, but in the debate on which one is better, or which one made more of an impact, which one was more influential on the wrestling business, I'm frankly shocked that it is even up for debate at all whether the NWO was bigger or DX was bigger. This is not even up for debate as far as I'm concerned. The NWO was far bigger than DX. Not just in terms of the number of actual, like, literal members they had, which was ridiculous after a while, but just its overall influence and popularity, the way that it disrupted the business, single-handedly led to the most prosperous period in wrestling history. Stone Cold came later on, The Rock came later, but it was the NWO first. Even that fucking t-shirt. It's that one and the Austin 316 shirt. They gotta be neck and neck as far as the highest-selling wrestling t-shirt of all time. Everybody, trust me when I say, at the time, everybody was wearing those NWO shirts. The NWO is what led to Nitro kicking Raw's ass for 83 weeks. The NWO is why Eric Bischoff has a job today doing a podcast called 83 Weeks. It's the NWO over DX every day of the week. But that doesn't mean DX wasn't a major part of the success of the Attitude Era. It was. After the DX biography, I watched the Rivals episode with Triple H and Mick Foley. Again, it was good. It was just a rehashing of, you know, from start to finish, where they started out with their careers in the company, how they came together, their whole feuding from the first match they had at the King of the Ring in the finals in 97 when Triple H won the crown, to the very last match that they had, which was the Hell in a Cell match, the career versus title at No Way Out 2000, where Triple H put down Cactus Jack for what was supposed to be the final time. And the funniest part of this entire episode is, they tell stories, they tell their version of the story, and it would have been nice if that would have been where Foley ended things. That would have been a great story to tell. Like Ric Flair losing to Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 24. What a great storybook ending that would have been for his career. But then reality sets in, and you can't tell that story without acknowledging the fact that those retirements were ruined by them coming back to the ring. They completely ignored the fact that only a month or so, month and a half, after that No Way Out match, not even a month and a half, they brought Foley back for WrestleMania 2000. Now, I can understand why they would want to, but it was comical. They built this whole ending of the episode around this great storybook ending for his career and, you know, what a moment to go out. And Foley is like, as I'm laying there in the hole in the ring when he got backdropped from the top of the cell, you know, down into the ring and they had the ring break. I'm laying there thinking, man, we had a good one. This is a great way, right? Perfect way for my career to end. You would never know if you're a brand new viewer. You would never know that it was only a few weeks later they called this fucking guy to come back. Foley thought he was done. He had every expectation of being retired and done and putting over Triple H and that's it, right? He even got his hair cut. He had that crappy haircut. And then he got called in because they wanted a McMahon in every corner. So we're going to dangle the carrot of a WrestleMania main event and a WrestleMania main event payoff. And he came back for one match. And frankly, wasn't very good. And it was one of those little blemishes on his career. The comeback with Randy Orton in 04 was actually much, much better. But yeah, it's unfortunate they brought him back for WrestleMania 2000, but for those wondering if they even acknowledged it, the answer is no. In their world, in their telling of the story, it doesn't even exist. It's the perfect creative booking for the end of this feud between two guys who are very influential in each other's careers, more so Foley with Triple H. Mick Foley is the one who made Triple H. And Triple H, you know, he acknowledges that here in this episode, and he says what Foley did for him was huge because Foley had credibility as a main eventer that he didn't have yet. He needed to have that first big program with a major name who he could beat and he could go toe-to-toe with, and in the eyes of the fans, it would give him credibility that up to that point he did not have, even though he was the champion. People didn't necessarily see him that way. They didn't accept him that way. I can tell you from my experience, watching that street fight at the Royal Rumble in Madison Square Garden is the night that I first truly looked at Triple H as a headline guy. It wasn't until that match that night after it was over that I said, man, that was, first of all, that was a great match, number one. One of the greatest in Royal Rumble history. And number two, okay, this was his arrival. He was already the champion, but this was Triple H's arrival here with this Royal Rumble match. But their careers were intertwined a lot even before that, going back to 97, the King of the Ring. They had a match at the Canadian Stampede pay-per-view. They had the cage match at SummerSlam in 97. They had the debut of Cactus Jack on Raw the month after that at Madison Square Garden. It was against Triple H. They had a whole bunch of matches that year. And those were also very important for Triple H. Because Triple H was, and this was right before DX started, but up to that point, Triple H was just the blue blood guy. This was the first time he really had a chance to go out there and show a mean streak and show aggression that we hadn't seen from him before. So Foley did him the favors even in 97, long before Triple H was a world champion. And then once he was a world champion, what did they do? They came right back to Foley. So at every turn, Foley did this guy, I mean, so many favors over the years. He really, in a lot of ways, he owes his career in many ways to Mick Foley. You know, maybe he would have gotten there anyway, even without him, but what Foley did for him was very selfless. And not everybody in that position that Foley was in at that time would have been as giving as he was to Triple H. But they had some fantastic matches together. I thought it was a good episode. Just very comical the way that it ended. We had a little reunion with them. I like how they do the reunions at the end. They did that with Bret and Shawn in their episode, where at the very end they kind of come together in the modern day and, you know, they talk to each other for a few minutes. So Foley and Triple H were sitting around just shooting the shit, and it was good to see. Because there have been comments over the years, I don't know if there was heat there, and Triple H, you know, not necessarily acknowledging what Foley did for him, but he went out of his way to make it very clear in this episode that what Mick did for him was huge in his career. Let's go through some mailbag questions here. If you have any to send to me, get them on in. TheSolemonster@gmail.com. It's been the same email address for 15 years. You should know it like the back of your hand. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Cliff, in Port Jefferson Station, New York. You know, I've lived in New York my whole life. I've never been to Port Jefferson Station before. During his time away from WWE in 2002, Steve Austin was arrested for beating Deborah, his wife at the time. He suffered no disciplinary action from WWE aside from the suspension that they had already imposed, which itself was a response to him walking out on the company. Within a year, he was back wrestling in WWE. The arrest had no effect on his employment. Considering how society has changed in the last 20 years, do you think WWE would have outright fired Austin if he had committed this crime in 2022 instead of 2002? Or do you think everything would have played out the same way? I think that he would have been let go. I think in today's climate, I don't, and this company now is much bigger and much more sensitive to bad PR. In a publicly traded company, which I guess even back then they were publicly traded, but they were not nearly as big as they are today and as corporate as they are today. Stuff that they would have turned a blind eye to back then, not that that still doesn't go on today, but that situation, I mean, they had fucking helicopters. I remember watching the media coverage of them going, you know, following Austin around. Austin had driven away from the house and the choppers up above were showing him meeting with the cops, and it was like a whole big thing on all the entertainment, you know, TV shows that night. He would have been let go. Now, I think he would have eventually been brought back, but yes, I think he would have been fired. Tom from Shanghai. Told you, this is a global show we have here. You never know who's listening from all over the world. I remember listening a few weeks ago where you mentioned Shawn Michaels having a better career after his return in 2002. This made me start thinking about The Undertaker. Do you think he had a better career pre-2000 or post-2000 after returning as the American Badass? Very good question. I will always have a soft spot for Undead Zombie Undertaker because that's what I grew up with. And I loved the feud with Mankind. But he wasn't even in the best shape of his career, physically, until, I'd say, maybe 2006, 2007. You know, the feuds and the matches that he had in the second half of his career, that's what really cemented this man's legacy. The best work from the first half of his run came in the later part of it, from like 96 to 98. The matches with Mankind, the matches with Bret and Shawn in 97, the Kane storyline, right? One of the all-time storylines in this company. I personally never really liked the Ministry stuff. They had a cool song, but I never cared much for the corporate Ministry or the Ministry. His return as the American Badass that night, though, in 2000 at Judgment Day is iconic. And the matches that he had with Brock Lesnar, with Kurt Angle, Randy Orton, Batista, Shawn Michaels, Triple H, Edge, CM Punk, were all great. They were all classics. The streak. My God, the streak. It wasn't even a thing in the first half of his career. That became such a big selling point of WrestleMania and such a big part of his career. It's like what defines him now. You think of The Undertaker, one of the first things you think of is the streak. Well, that didn't exist. People didn't talk about that in the first half of his career. Not until he got to like 9-0, 10-0, and that came later on. So the answer is his post-2000 career. The second half, or I guess it's a little more than half, but that second part of The Undertaker's career post-2000 was the bigger part of his overall run. That's really where he peaked. He peaked physically, which is hard to believe because he was being told by doctors in 98 that he needed to retire then and have a double hip replacement. That was in 1998, the first time a doctor said that to him. He didn't hit his physical peak until like 06, 07. And then you look at the body of work he put together and, you know, the storytelling. He's very much a fan of that whole WrestleMania story arc for those 4 years. I think if you were to ask him, because he basically said this in all of the interviews that he's, you know, done, he's most proud of that. From WrestleMania 25 through WrestleMania 28, it's like a 4-year period there. He's most proud of those 4 matches and that whole story arc that they put together. So even in terms of storytelling, he had the stronger run post-2000. JD from Chincheck Sports Radio. Now that we have seen the final, quote-unquote final, match between Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar, are they each other's greatest rival? Brock Lesnar had rivalries with Kurt Angle, Undertaker, Roman Reigns. Roman has had big matches with Lesnar, Braun Strowman, and maybe Seth Rollins. What do you think? I had to think about this, because it wasn't an easy, like, no-brainer answer. I really want to go with Kurt Angle as Lesnar's greatest rival. I mean, they were both so evenly matched. They had great matches together in 03. But it was really just 03. It was really just that 1 year. But when you say greatest rival, here's my question. Are we talking the best matches? Or do we want to take into account the outcomes of those matches story-wise? Because if you do that, I think you have to go with Roman Reigns. Not counting any of the triple threats or fatal four ways that they were in together, they had that great match at WrestleMania 31 that neither of them ended up winning. Brock beat him at WrestleMania 34. And after that, Lesnar doesn't have a single win over Roman Reigns. Not one. Roman beat him at SummerSlam in 2018. He beat him at Crown Jewel last year. He beat him at WrestleMania this year. And he beat him again at SummerSlam. No man has that many singles wins and that kind of dominance over Brock Lesnar. Brock has not been able to figure this guy out. So I think you probably should call Roman Reigns his greatest rival if that's how you want to look at it. Roman has been his toughest challenge. Now, Roman's greatest rival is probably Brock Lesnar by default. I don't think Roman has that one truly great rival like everybody else has. I would throw Bray Wyatt on the list of possibility. I wouldn't pick Bray, but I would put Bray on the list. He didn't mention Bray Wyatt's name. I think he's got to be on the list of possibilities. Braun Strowman is close. They had some really good matches together. Actually, that feud is what put Strowman on the map after he broke away from the Wyatt family. It was the matches he had with Roman Reigns. They're just, I don't know, even with Strowman, there just isn't that one guy that I automatically think of, other than Brock, when I think of greatest rivals for Roman Reigns. You know, the way that when I think of Bret Hart, I think of Steve Austin or Shawn Michaels. When I think of Hulk Hogan, I think of Randy Savage, or I think of Andre the Giant. When I think of Stone Cold, I think of The Rock. I think of Mr. McMahon. With The Rock, I think of Austin or Triple H. With Mick Foley, I think of Undertaker or Triple H. With John Cena, I think of CM Punk or Edge. You get the picture. Usually, it's pretty easy to identify at least one, if not two different names. Like, okay, that's the guy's greatest rival. It's harder with Roman. Roman doesn't really have that one guy. I would say Brock is the closest thing. I know some of you are fans of the TV show Better Call Saul. I got a lot of questions about this, so I just wanted to quickly address this. Because I did watch the series finale on Monday night. It's the final episode, 6 seasons. Show's been going on for many years now. And it was a spinoff of one of the greatest television shows of all time, Breaking Bad. It's in my top three of all-time favorite TV shows. We got The Sopranos, we got The Shield, we got Breaking Bad. They're all in that top three. So Better Call Saul, for those who don't know, is a spinoff series based on one of the characters, and not even one of the major characters. It's almost like a side, maybe side isn't the right word, but like a minor character from Breaking Bad. And they created this entire other universe and this entire other series that mostly focuses on his story arc and development and what came before what we see from him on Breaking Bad. But there's also jump cuts to the modern day. I don't want to give... See, the thing is, I don't want this to be a spoiler review. So I have to be careful with what I say here. I don't want to give too much away because I absolutely would recommend that you watch this show. You don't necessarily have to watch Breaking Bad in order to watch Better Call Saul, but it is highly, highly suggested that you watch that first and then watch this. Because otherwise you're not going to be able to fully appreciate a lot of the little things about this show and the end of it either. But now that it's over, you know, I can sit here and tell you that what Vince Gilligan put together here with this show is amazing. This show was better than it had any right to be. And I think the first few seasons, it started out slow because what this story is, it really is more of a character study than anything else. Breaking Bad, I think, was the better show for the tension and the drama and the action and all that, especially in those last couple of seasons. It was insane. Season 5. Okay, if you've seen that show, enough said. You know what I'm talking about. Better Call Saul, it's a better character study. And the writing is some of the best I've ever seen. But then it starts to really pick up a lot in the last couple of seasons. Kind of similar to Breaking Bad, honestly. It really picks up a lot in the last couple of seasons, and it ended up being one of the greatest shows I've ever seen. When I think of where it ranks, again, I don't know exactly where it ranks, but it's right up there with Breaking Bad. It really is. It's like two different shows in a lot of ways, because you have everything that made Bob Odenkirk's character what he would later become, and all the flash forwards to the post Breaking Bad timeline. We go back and forth a lot. We don't even get the Saul Goodman character until, what, season 4 is where he really is kind of birthed in Better Call Saul, and that's the character people saw in Breaking Bad. That's how long it took to give him that backstory to even get to the point where you see that version of him. It took about 3 or 4 seasons to even get to that point. But just the level of detail and the way the show is shot and the writing, everything about it, I loved it. Loved it. I fell in love with this show. The show is one of the greatest television shows ever made. And I've never seen a show before where they take a minor character like that from one show and they just create this entire other show out of it that rivals the original. And some people would say it's even better. I wouldn't argue with you if you think Better Call Saul is better than Breaking Bad. I would give Breaking Bad the slight edge, but they're right there. What they have created in these two shows is legendary. Two of the greatest shows of all time. And again, I don't want to give much away in terms of spoilers or anything like that, because I really would encourage you, if you are not a fan of the show, if you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor. I've made recommendations and suggestions on this podcast over the years when it comes to movies, when it comes to TV shows. I'd like to think my record is pretty good. I'm not looking to waste your time. I've gotten so many emails from people saying, thank you so much for turning me onto The Shield. I had never heard of the show. I didn't know about it. It's my new favorite show. It's great. Do yourself a favor. Watch Breaking Bad and then watch Better Call Saul. And stick with it. Because it does take time to get going, but stick with it. Because it really is one of the greatest shows ever made. And of course, I'm sad that it's over now. I'm sad that the Breaking Bad universe is officially done. I mean, never say never, I guess. But it's sad that it's over. But man, it was a hell of a ride. So I very much enjoyed. And I thought that the ending, as bittersweet as it was actually very satisfying. I like the ending of the show. I can't say that about all of the shows that I've ever seen, but I will tell you that it is up there in terms of great endings, although I think it's going to be very hard to top the ending of The Shield. But there's a reason why I call these my favorite shows of all time. They stuck the landing. Unlike a show like Dexter. I had a friend who watched Dexter. I never saw Dexter. But he was such a huge Dexter fan, and then he would just... He would go off about how the show ended and the last, it might have been the last like season or two even, but like how it just fell off a cliff and oh my God, it was like trending towards the greatest thing ever. And then they didn't know how to finish it. They ruined it. They didn't do that with this. So I was very happy to see that. I think they gave it a very good ending. I think they did it justice. So anyway, if you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. I will be live this week after Raw Monday night, after Dynamite on Wednesday. We'll see, right? CM Punk and Jon Moxley. I have every expectation that Tony Khan is not false advertising this match, but what are they going to do? We'll go live after to talk about it, Friday night, after SmackDown. And don't forget, next Sunday, House of Glory. There will be a podcast next Sunday. I'll probably try to record it a day early if I can. So my suggestion to you, if you are going to drop a PayPal donation, if you want that shout out, try to get them in on the earlier side. Don't wait until the last minute. Otherwise, it may have to wait for the following week. But that'll be episode 771 next Sunday. Be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a fantastic week. And I will see you back here for 771. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster sounds off.
We've got Ice Mocha, lot of weed. Ice Mocha, lot of weed. I see. Oh, for some reason, I thought, I don't know, I was reading it just the way I was, just the way I was reading it. I gotta get through this. He says, new idea for Be the Booker. And give their tag team a name. Pick two random wrestlers. Example. I don't know why I'm laughing. Oh, I fucking hate you for this. I fucking hate you for this.
The Solemonster sounds off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow The Solemonster on Twitter @Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster sounds off.